Even when the Leafs are on buys, we do Good Shows Leafs Hour, brought to you by Drive Auto Group, fueled by customer expectations. Ben Ennis, JD Bunkus. Boy, did I miss a maelstrom of Leafs activity the last week or so. I did actually watch the last 5 minutes in overtime of the Calgary game. I saw highlights of the Saturday game against the Chicago Blackhawks, that leads to the discussion about Frederik Andersen, because how many of those goals does he want back? Four?
So, again, just to play off of the theme of what you discussed in the last block about how now there are essentially, and a lot of it is our own fault for paying too much attention to it anyways, but what you missed is essentially now there are two Twitter silo factions.
Oh, okay. Tell me about them.
The Twitter silo faction one is that the Leafs are so soft in their own end and that they gave up too many odd man rushes. And that has equated to these embarrassing performances. That there's, Sheldon Keefe said that they don't have a maturity to them. Or they lack a maturity, and some people are, I guess, mad about that. And then there's the other faction which says that it's Freddie Andersen and it's simply a matter of save percentage, and that if you just look at everything, it's all things are equal. It's just that Freddie Andersen has been bad. The truth is it's somewhere in the middle as
yeah.
well. The problem is that that's just not the world we live in. But let's get smarter about it, and let's ask somebody who actually knows things and how to evaluate them. It's Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine, a goaltender expert. What's up, man?
Not much. Would it be oversimplifying if I just said put those two hands together? A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Listen, if you say it's both things together, you're fighting both sides. Mm. Like you're in the middle, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make you a consolidator. It makes you an enemy of both parties.
Right. They're both going to shoot you in, I don't know, the sides of the ribs or the back when you're turning to talk to the other side. I don't know how it's going to work, but that's kind of some gist.
I'll take that bullet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do it. Let's take some bullets here. Let's start with that. Like Freddie has got a sub 900 save if you remove that spectacular November. And generally, like I hate that kind of commentary where it's like, well, if you remove the good parts or you remove the bad parts, this is what a guy is. But are you a little worried about what you've seen from him this season? Or if you're not, when would you start to be?
I guess you'd start to be, well, this recent stretch is not his best, right? What's he got? Like, I think he's got, like, at the same time, he's got, what, three regulation losses since mid-December? Like, there have been some, it's sort of like the 80s Oilers at times, right? Like, some 8-6 type games, and his numbers have struggled for it. And it's, you know, the environment isn't great. It has improved only slightly. In terms of expected save percentage since they made the coaching change. But at the same time, there's no point sugarcoating. Like, he hasn't been great the last little while. Like, this is not just about the environment. I think what you worry about if you're a Leafs fan, and this is the thing about defensive environments and giving up to certain types of chances, whether it's odd man rushes or, you know, actually slot area shots, since the coaching change, since Sheldon Keefe took over, Freddie's seen the second most in the NHL, behind only Mackenzie Blackwood and just one more than Carey Price, like 59 since that change, and his save percentage is actually about 8% below expected on those shots. And so that's one where you're like, okay, there's an area where that particular type of shot is something they're giving up more than almost any other team since the new coach took over, and he's not having success with it. So as a coaching staff and as a team, you can take a look at that, whether it's what we're giving up or whether it's how he's playing it. I guess I don't really worry about this dip this last little while, because it's a little worse than normal, but he goes through one of these every year, no?
Yeah. Yep.
Like, didn't we talk, like last year he was amongst the league leaders, and, you know, I want to say it was probably later in the season last year, maybe February, maybe March. Can't remember off the top of my head, but it was kind of around a visit to Vancouver, if I recall, or shortly after, where he was sort of starting to be in a Vezina conversation, and then he took a little nosedive, and statistically, he dropped right out of that conversation. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, wrung their hands at the time over that. And yet when the puck dropped on the playoffs, I thought Freddie was really good.
Yeah.
And I know they didn't get out of the first round, but I thought he was really good. And if you don't see signs of that turnaround, maybe you worry. But they're sort of, I can't tell you why. Maybe he takes his foot off the gas a little bit. I'm not sure what it is. But he seems to have one of these dips. The only thing I would worry about for him is bad environments become cumulative, in my opinion. Edmonton Oilers are example A. How many goaltenders have left Edmonton in shambles statistically and had success elsewhere? Eventually, if the slot line and the seam passes get through enough, the ones that aren't supposed to get through, the seam that's supposed to have a stick in it, the lane that's supposed to be taken away, and you trust it to be taken away, and it gets through 7, 8, 9 times in a row, well, guess what? On number 10, you're cheating. And as soon as you're cheating in this league, you're screwed on the short side. Somebody's going to have their head up and see it and pick you apart. And so I do worry about the defensive environment there over time becoming cumulative for him, but I don't, and that's what you have to worry about with Freddie Anderson in Toronto. But I don't really worry about it yet. Like, I don't think we're there yet. Also, there's been a coaching change. You guys would know better than me about the details defensively and what's being asked of the guys in front of him. They appear to have changed a little bit, but again, you see it on a day-in, day-out basis. And as a goaltender, being able to read off that and trust that guys are going to make the right reads, and if there's been any tweaks in what they're being asked to do systems-wise or structure-wise, you have to, A, adjust your reads to that, and then, B, learn to trust them to, like, when everyone's learning it together, there can be some stumbles because you're counting on them to do it, they're learning it as well, and sometimes you both do the wrong things, and pretty soon nobody's doing their job. I don't think, like I said, overall the defensive environment isn't that much worse or that much better since Keith arrived. It's kind of similar, so I don't think it's been drastic, but the little reads within that might lead to a poor performance overall on slot plays. Sometimes those are the kind of things that can take time.
This is why it's complicated in general, right? Like, this is not an easy thing to just be able to identify and say, well, this is why.
There's no black and white.
Exactly. There's just so many mitigating factors to all of this that make it really tough. But there's a few things here and a few things that you mentioned that I think are really interesting. Like, one is, you know, historically, Anderson has been really good in these types of games where it's a lot of shots against him. Like, he's got a overwhelming winning record when he faces more than 40 shots in a game. Like, it seems to be something that suits him. And he's had a really high workload. And over the last couple of seasons, I think he's faced more shots than anybody else over the last 3 years, played more games than anybody else over the last 3 years. And basically, at the end of every season, he has one of these lulls like he's having right now. And we end up looking at it somewhere between, I think, 916 and a 918 save with moments of brilliance and slumpy moments. So, yeah, he's a tough guy to kind of have a hard opinion on in general at times. I guess there's two concerns. One is that you mentioned already, which is, do you ever get a breaking point sometimes, or do you just start to kind of get fed up? And I don't think that Anderson would ever go into a game consciously thinking, like, I don't have it tonight, or, you know, I'm not going to do my absolute best. But just the wear and tear mentally of always playing in front of a team like this, and then compounding that with that workload that I mentioned beforehand, and that this is why the more and more you do things like this, and now the earlier this kind of stuff is showing up, that maybe that's kind of the reason where you look at it and say, well, oof, maybe it's less likely that there's this full and complete bounce back because now you've just added so much more on top of an already, like, really high pile.
I guess it's possible, but I don't know that, like, it's the Curtis Joseph thing, right? Always better when busy. Like, that was, you know, I mean, remember when he went to Detroit and all of a sudden it was behind a team that, where he wasn't facing an avalanche of shots. And he struggled with it, right? Like, I think openly and admittedly, not every goalie is at their best when they're not busy. Some goalies are better busy goaltenders. And I think it's fair to say that Freddie, you know, it can be one of those where he's at his best when he's busy. We're seeing with Jacob Markstrom here right now, who, by the way, quietly is having a Vezina Trophy candidacy-type season. Nobody seems to notice it, however. With a 916 raw save percentage, when you adjust it, because he has been so busy, he's actually been the best in the league in terms of the goals he's saved through companies like, you know, having a peek under the hood at Clearsight Analytics and his numbers there. But he's a guy who, the one thing he hasn't faced is nights where he's not busy. And he's another guy who, when he's busy, he's great. Not when he's not, and he doesn't have to worry about it behind the defense in Vancouver, thank goodness for him, I guess. He tends to fall off a little bit. And Freddie tends to be one of those guys, too, and I think it goes to the workload thing. Like, everybody wants to get him below a magic number, and I think it's how you do it is important. Like, he may be better when he's busy from a games played perspective, and so as much as around the league over the past 15 years, everybody wants to talk about, you know, specifics of staying under 60 or the new ideal is 55 starts, that may not be his ideal. Maybe it's a higher number. And I think what they have to find there is a consistency to getting him there more steadily as opposed to starts and fits where, okay, now we're going to play the backup a bunch more and give him time off, because that seems to not work as well for him. Like, you need to find a sort of steady, balanced workload for him. And, you know, I think it goes down to more than just big, broad strokes about what the number is around the league, what the number needs to be, what goalies need to stay below. It really becomes a lot more individual, and you have to, you know, maybe accept that Freddie Anderson is a guy who's better when he's busy, when he plays more games, and, you know, you're not going to roll him out there 77 like Grant Fuhr would in the day, but maybe he's above that 60 mark, and maybe that's okay, because he played a lot last year, and I thought last year a lot of people talked about, again, you know, the magic number, yet he was injured early, and then it felt to me down the stretch like they were playing the wheels off him, and I think that's what I said when the number started to dip late in the season. It's like, let's have a little balance here. And yet again, when the puck dropped on game one in the playoffs, he was that was the Freddie Anderson that you said, the good Freddie Anderson, the guy who gets into conversations about, you know, being a top five goaltender. So you sort of have to trust the relationship between him and Steve Briere. And we talked about this. I talked about this with Freddie when he was in town. Like, he trusts it. He trusts that they have a plan to come out of this when they come out of the All-Star break. And I think as much as Leafs Nation might not want to, you have to kind of trust that too, that they're going to get there together, that this is just one of those lulls, and they'll come back and work on the things that are leading to, you know, lower than expected slot area save percentage against a huge workload in there, lower than expected breakaway save percentage, which is part of the cumulative numbers being a little underwater to this date.
Maybe part of the plan is getting another backup goaltender, and maybe that means that the Rangers lower their asking price on Alexander Georgiev, who is apparently they're trying to fetch a massive return on him. Where do you see his value at? Do you see him as a potential starter down the line, as one of the top-end backups? Where do you see him?
Okay, well, two parts there. Like, you'd have to accept that Hutchinson, like, am I wrong from the outside in saying that Hutch has been a lot better of late, like, statistically?
Well, it couldn't have been worse.
Yeah,
let me throw one at you. So the game that almost ended Hutchinson's NHL career, the Chicago game,
yeah,
right? You guys remember that better. What if I told you he outperformed Robin Lehner in that game statistically?
That sounds like a beginning of a 30-for-30 where Michael Hutchinson is about to become like a starting goaltender in the Stars.
No, I'm not trying to say it, but in that game where everybody's ready to bury him because they had 53 shots or whatever it was, and Robin Lehner stood on his head with 50-plus saves, and Hutchinson, you know, gave up 4 on 30. If you actually took a look at the math, and again, Clearside Analytics does a better job than anyone in terms of breaking down expected save percentage, 34 points a data per shot. I got a peek under the hood at that game.
Yeah.
Hutchinson, actually, his expected goals were higher than the 4 he gave up. And on those 57 shots that the Leafs created, they actually had less than half from a quality perspective than the Blackhawks did in their 30. And their expected goals was actually below what Lehner. So a lot of this narrative, I don't think the starts especially have been fair to Hutchinson. His expected save percentage this year from Clearside is a little over 88. That's among the lowest in the league. The only guys that are sort of in that range that play a lot more are like Martin Jones and Braden Holtby, and the conversation about them is about how horse crap their defense is in front of them. So let's start there. But then in terms of Georgiev, he outperforms his environment and has consistently since he got into the NHL. I like him. I'm a big fan. I don't know what he's worth. To me, here's what he's worth. He is worth whatever you're willing to pay to have a 1B. Upside to me is not NHL starter, elite number one, although there's potential there. He's 6'1". He's got incredible speed and incredible patience. And he has, like I said, over his 3 years, outperformed his environment in terms of, and there's another team that plays it pretty wide open right now with the New York Rangers. I see him as Saros with a little more size and upside. Like, that's kind of, you know, your ideal 1B, a guy who, if your starter's out for a month, you can go to him and give him starter's minutes for a stretch. In an era where we're moving towards 1A, 1B more and more around the league, he may be a perfect fit, and he's cost-controlled and all those things. What he's worth to you is the difference between what he's going to cost you to get him and have him under control as an RFA versus going out and buying that type of 1B goaltender on the open market this summer, because three of the best are all available. Yaroslav Halak, Thomas Greiss, and Anton Khudobin, the poster children of 1B in the NHL today. I mean, what's Khudobin's leading the NHL in save percentage last I checked. They're all unrestricted free agents this summer. So to me, what's Georgie worth? He's worth whatever you see the value of getting him cheap and having him cheap and cost-controlled for a while versus having to pay for it on the open market in UFA, because there's a bunch of those types of goaltenders, older but also more experienced, that are going to be available for no cost in terms of having to give up an asset, just what you got to pay them on July 1st.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's such a tough one for them to actually do it. I've seen some people estimate that it would cost the Leafs more than simply Kasperi Kapanen to acquire him, which seems like
that quite, seems a little crazy to right. me when you have a list of, like, take a look at the UFA yep. list this summer. Like, it seems like a high price tag, and I'm a fan, obviously, of Georgiev. He's got a great backstory too, from Russia, which is where all the good goaltenders come from these days. But actually learned to play the position in Finland, and he's got a real mix of sort of Russian skating skill and active Finnish hands and patience. And like, I really like his game, but at the risk of my goalie union card, that is a really high price when some of the biggest names and some of the best 1B options we've seen over the last 3 years are all on the open market this summer. It's a fascinating time for goalies because there's a lot of good ones available this summer. Robin Lehner, Jacob Markstrom, Braden Holtby, Corey. Like, there's a deep list. So you're going to give up an asset now to get half a season and a guy who's cost controlled for the next few? I can't answer what that's worth, but that seems like a really steep price.
Yeah, it's worth more to the Leafs because of their cap situation, right, to have that guy. But if they are going to justify paying like a really heavy asset like that, especially considering, you know, the assets that they've already parted with, yeah, I think you do have to believe that he's either going to be that 1A, 1B, because it doesn't seem extremely likely that Freddie Anderson is going to be here for the long haul now. Like, if you look at the market that was done for, even if we don't think that it's going to be right there with Vasilevsky or Bobrovsky, that he's going to command a pretty significant dollar amount, unless, and Ben was talking about this with me earlier, that maybe this thing is shifting, and based on the way that Bobrovsky has performed, especially, and based on like some of these goaltenders and the way that we evaluate that position as you get a little bit older, that maybe it's going to shift pretty rapidly when it comes to what older starting goaltenders get when it comes to term and average dollar amount.
Well, it could this summer. It'll be interesting. And Robin Lehner is going to be a test case because he's not actually that much an older goaltender. He's 28, right? But as we see these, to your point, as the other part is the youth movement, right? Like Carter Hart, Samsonov is outperforming Holtby, at least statistically, under a much less workload with the Washington Capitals and a tough decision coming there. Shesterkin, and the guy who's created all this buzz in New York, is 23 years old. Like, we are seeing this whole goaltenders take longer thing. Still applies to some. You still got your Binningtons of the world at 26 breaking onto the scene. But these sort of high-end kids coming from Russia and some of the prospects, like, you don't got to wait 4 or 5 years anymore. And so as you see them have success, the cost of having veterans under contract for long term, like the Florida one, makes me scratch my head. Like forget Bob's struggles to adjust there, but drafting Spencer Knight, who's going to be one of these kids who's going to be ready in 2 or 3 years, in my opinion, and then also basically putting a ceiling in front of him for the next seven, that, like, to me, that didn't make a lot of sense. Florida's also a poster child for, and again, at the risk of having my goalie union card snatched right out of my wallet here, you know, give me some truth serum. And a few goalie coaches have shared this with me. I won't give their names, but some really, you know, some very recognizable goaltending coach names have said, if you tell me to build our team, we can have four good centers down the middle, four great top four on D, or an elite number one superstar goaltender in net. Give me the elite top four on D, and I'll build your goaltender that can play behind it. Carolina Hurricanes, thank you very much. Waiver wire claim and a reclamation project Eastern Conference final last year. James Reimer, the reclamation project in Mrazek is struggling again this year. You talk about goals saved above average. He's actually bottom five in the NHL behind that defense. But James Reimer right now, who was basically somebody they had to take on to get rid of Scott Darling's contract, you know, is performing at around a 920 clip and above average. They built a team where goaltender is almost an afterthought to them, as opposed to Hey, let's just have a great defense and we can plug, I won't say anyone, but your options are a lot more wide open in terms of what you can get away with behind there. The other thing on Georgiev, guys, like if he's a 1B in that mold of he can give you 30 to 40, and we just talked about Freddie Anderson being better when he's busy, does that fit? Like, do you see Freddie having success in a 45-game role?
The thing with him is he said before the season that he basically, I want to remember what his number is specifically.
50-something.
Yeah, it was below, yeah, I think it was 55 as well. Like, I think he's at the point now, especially with his free agency coming up, that's going to be the thing that people point to, is they're like, hey, man, sorry, but there's so many miles on the tires. You faced all these shots. You played in front of this Toronto team, and now you're in your 30s, and... Yeah.
Well, $10 million for a Bob didn't look good.
Yeah, so he said he would like to be in the ballpark of the mid-50s before the season. So I don't know if it goes that low into the 40s, but yeah, I think it's got to be below 60 moving forward.
And I guess, to me, the negotiation to keep an eye on then this summer is Robin Lehner. Mm-hmm. When we talk about setting the market and what the new market is going to be for goaltenders, and not that one guy's going to set it, but Robin Lehner proved last year that he, like, in the past 2 years, he has proven he can play it anyway.
Yep.
He succeeds behind a good defensive team with the New York Islanders. He goes to Chicago, and, I talked about, again, the adjusted numbers, and obviously you guys can't have these in front of you, but when you look at the proprietary stuff, the adjusted numbers around the league, like Markstrom's number one in terms of goals saved, and Robin Lehner is number two. Like, he is repeating it behind a team that is very different. I've talked to him about having to change his style behind that team. He's more dynamic. Look at all the, like, pad stacks, butter stacks, as we call them, the old butterfly slide into a pad stack. Like, he's thrown his technical book, all the things that he changed and improved in New York to become more refined and technical. I shouldn't say all of them, but a bunch of them he's had to throw out the window. He's like, I've got to be more dynamic, more aggressive. Like, he has shown that he can play it both ways and play it at a top two or three level. Should probably be... The GMs vote, and they seem to not have access to the same numbers I do based on some of their voting. So maybe he won't be a Vezina finalist, but he damn well should be this year. And he's heading into an open market where he's already said, like, I'm not taking a discount just because I went through some mental health issues. Like, I'm showing you what I can do here. So that is going to be fascinating, and that could go a long way to determining what this does look like. You're right. In an era where we don't want goalies to play more than 60 games, how much are we going to value that guy? And that obviously will affect how the Leafs approach negotiations with Freddie.
Kevin, great stuff as always. Thanks for this.
Awesome stuff, Kevin.
My pleasure, guys.
Okay. There's Kevin Woodley, NHL.com, In Goal magazine. He knows a little bit about goaltending.
That's awesome. I love getting to pick his brain. I'm always really grateful when he comes on.
But yeah, that's a really interesting topic of conversation, because the last couple of signings of mid-30s goalies have gone so pear-shaped. And Robin Lehner is a little bit younger.
Man, look at Carey Price's contract.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah. I have Habs buddies who will send me texts like, oh, well, what do you think if we did this trade? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Who's going to trade for Carey Price's contract without making the Habs eat the vast majority of it? Like, yep. That's going down. It really does remind me, and I've said this before, man. I said this in the summer, that goaltenders are going to become like running backs.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to have tandems. You're going to not want to be giving them the huge contracts. Like, Kevin is, this is his bread and butter. This is his field. This is what he talks about. And you hear the guy talking about the more importance of blue line and structure in front of your goaltender rather than just trying to find those blue chip studs. I think that, just like a lot of things in the NHL, there's becoming more parity in net. Like,
yeah.
Freddie Anderson is maybe my favorite Leafs player. I love watching him. He's one of my favorite Leafs goalies ever. And it's an organization that in my lifetime has had Felix Potvin, Curtis Joseph, and Ed Belfour. Sorry to all the other guys. I thought Michael Tellqvist was going to be a guy. Turned out I bought stock.
Damian Rhodes?
I still have Michael Tellqvist stock in a closet at home somewhere.
Really?
It's in a box.
Huh.
It's in a box buried deep in the closet. But yeah, it's the more evidence and the more the way that things are going and the more of what you see in terms of workloads and money and cap allocation, it keeps telling you that go younger with the position, have two guys, limit workloads, play hot hands.
Yeah, don't allow a million odd man rushes against.
Yeah, try to find a better way to not pummel your goalie into submission like the Leafs have in the last little bit.
I'm with you. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to a man who not only burned the tip of his nose in Mexico, his entire body Matthew Barnaby. Next, we continue Good Show's Leafs Hour, brought to you by Drive Auto Group, fueled by customer expectations. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Our love was unexplored, born of gravity and light. I crawl out of your ocean, your beauty tied inside. You gave me your sunshine, your skin to keep me warm. Your hurricane soon became my sleepy golden storm. But it's too late to look back now.
It's Good Show's Leafs Hour, brought to you by Drive Auto Group, fueled by customer expectations. Ben Ennis, back from vacation.
Yeah, the two richest guys I know. My two richest friends.
I don't know if... Yeah, you obviously don't know many people.
Actually, sorry. No, you know what's great? Yesterday, I had Colby on. My three richest friends. And Colby's talking about going to Barbados and how he likes to spend... How he used to like to spend the All-Star break in Barbados. And he's fresh off of coming back from Disney. And you're coming back from Cancun. And I don't know, where were you, Matthew Barnaby? Where in Mexico were you?
Right outside of Cancun, about 15 minutes, yeah. So, what was your adventure? What happened, Ben? I just saw your tweet.
Brutal, buddy. My one-year-old had, I had a seizure, frankly. It was like what's called a febrile seizure, which is, he had a high fever and he had a little miniature seizure, which at the time is, terrifying. We had to get in an ambulance, ended up in the hospital. He's fine now. Everything seems to be fine. But yeah,
good.
Ruined the holiday, no question, because that happened on Saturday and we only got back yesterday. But I hopefully your trip was a little better. Although looking at your tweets, I mean, you also had issues, not to the same degree because you're a grown man and you should know better. But yeah, dude, it's hot and the sun is bright. Wear sunscreen.
Yeah, don't play beach volleyball for 8 hours and not be good at it,
dude,
and not wear sunscreen in 90-degree weather. I was told by my girlfriend over and over, put sunscreen on. I'm like, nah, it's okay, I'll be fine. Well, after throwing up for 15 straight hours and not being able to look at food for 2 days, it'll never happen again. It's a defining moment in my life, boys.
That's what you guys get. Like, the rich, you guys go to your holidays and you guys don't wear sunscreen because you think nothing can affect you. Nothing can touch you, wealthy folk. You're like, we're invincible. We're kiss the sky. You're literally Icarus, like every single one of you with your no sunskreen. Ben with his red nose, you with your red skin.
That was a mistake. I was trying to put sunscreen on because I'm not a moron like Matthew Barnaby. You actually put no sunscreen on.
In Mexico,
you're coming
too.
From Canada, where you haven't seen the sun in months, and you're like, no, it's only like the brightest
you
sun.
You live in Ottawa. Ottawa, buddy.
It was day three. I thought I had a great baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so great. One time I fell asleep on a beach in California, and I had been surfing, so I was wearing this rash guard. For those that don't know, it's like a... It protects you completely from the sun and from scraping your stomach on a surfboard grip.
Okay, never heard
and
of that.
So... You're wearing this thing, and I took it off, and I just passed out on the beach. But you don't put sunscreen underneath a rash guard because, again, it's 100% sunproof. I woke up, and it was like an hour and a half later, 2 hours later, and then I had to get on a plane the next day. I know how you felt getting on that plane. Here's the question of how bad it was. Did one of the stewardess or flight attendants ask you, is there anything I can do? What can I do for you? Because then you know it's really, really bad.
By the time I got on the plane, I was actually fine.
Okay.
It was 2 days later. So
I don't bounce back like that.
It was 15 hours of hell. But once it was done, I was fine by the time I got on the plane, and I'm fine now. But if you still hear my voice, it's still a little scratchy because that's how much I threw up in that 15-hour span.
I picture you like thinking in your head that you look like, you know, Tom Cruise in Top Gun playing beach volleyball, having a time. You're like, this is great.
Wearing
I look like
jeans,
a hunk. Like, I look cool. I look cool, cool, cool. And in reality, it's just like you had a buzz on. You probably stunk at volleyball. You're getting a blur. You're getting a burn. People will say, you look a little pink. You're like, I'll be fine. It's great. It's great. It's going to be perfect. So, yeah.
We had a couple of Goose Maverick high fives on the beach, too, but certainly didn't look great doing it.
That's a shame. All right. So, Maple Leafs are not all the way back to where they were under Mike Babcock, but it's an uphill climb now, too, because the Panthers, they don't lose. Now, the games in hand, they're all gone, but 4 points back of a team that's playing some pretty good hockey right now. I guess the Leafs still have, you know, there's still the wild card potentially, but that's of a higher point total than the Panthers right now. Where Where do you feel about the Maple Leafs playoff chances as we stand here in the bye?
Well, I don't like their game as of late. Their MVP probably last 2 years has struggled in the last month. And, you know, I think a little time away for these guys is good. But it's the same story. You know, they can't outscore their mistakes every single night. And that's, you know, defensively, they still struggle with defensive coverage at times and lapses and turnovers. And it's the same story over and over. The question is now, are they able to rally with some of their big guys out on the back end who also haven't been great this year, but with those guys out of the lineup, it puts the onus on other players. And can they survive that in the short term to keep them in the hunt? Because that's going to be very important for them just to stay in the hunt. And the next question is, what do they add at the trade deadline to help this team to not only become a contender, but just a playoff team? So they aren't out of it. There's a lot of runway left. There's a lot of good hockey that they have played. But obviously the struggles have been real in this last month.
Yeah, it's so hard because they look so good, then they look so bad, and they put together the stretch that's so great, and then they put together this little stretch that's bad, and I almost find myself, like, exhausted by them. Just, it's a different type of watch, it's a different type of consumption, and I keep hearing from some people that, you know, it's an 82-game season, so this is kind of the way that it goes, but don't you feel like this is, or not? I don't even think, don't you feel, is this different than what most teams do, most good teams do? The way that this team wins versus the way that it loses, because to me, it's completely different.
It is completely different because I think really good teams win the 2-1, 3-1, 1-0 games. That's not Toronto's MO. They're winning 6-4 and 5-3. And again, they can score with the best of them, but there's going to be nights where you struggle through that. And I don't think really good teams lose 5 out of 6 or 4 out of 6. They lose one here. They might lose 2 in a row once during the year, but they're very good at not going on streaks where they lose a lot. I think it was very uncanny for Boston to have the little streak that they went on about, you know, 3 weeks ago, to them struggling really with all parts of their game. So it starts in net. If they don't get the goaltending that Freddie Anderson we've been accustomed to in the last 2 years, then it won't be a playoff team. That's flat out plain and simple. They aren't good enough defensively to not have great goaltending. And average goaltending to even good goaltending, I don't think will be good enough for this team to be a playoff team.
What are you going to pay attention to the most when it comes to watching Rasmus Sandin?
Just him without the puck. You know, he's an elite skater, passes the puck well. His first pass is great. He supports the rush very well. But any young defenseman that plays in this league that isn't the biggest guy is going to have to be very aware defensively. And guys are bigger. They're stronger. They're faster. They're smarter than any level that he's ever played at. So to play without the puck for any young defenseman, but especially an offensive defenseman, a puck-moving defenseman, that's the biggest thing.
You're not a goalie expert. We had one of those on earlier in the program, but you've seen the game lots. I mean, is there a level of concern that you're looking at a 30-year-old Frederick Anderson who's had this incredible workload over the last 3 years that, man, maybe he's just worn down?
I'm not. I'm not worried for it. I don't think 30 is that old. I think we put too much of an onus on that. And I think we've wanted Freddie to play a little bit more, maybe, you know, on back-to-backs. But no, I don't have any problem with that. I think every player struggles once in a while. And it's up to the rest of the team to be able to carry that guy, or parts of teams carry guys when they go in slumps. If you're an offensive guy, you're going to struggle at times for 5-6 games in a row. Well, it's the same in every single position, but the other guys have to be able to be that much better on days that you struggle. Unfortunately, their struggles have continued while Freddie's have struggled at the same time.
Barney, it's good to hear that you've recovered from, you know, your stupidity, but good job.
You never recover from that, just so you know.
No. I'm going to learn from it. You always learn from your mistakes. Yeah. Trust me. Yeah. You always learn from your mistakes. I'm just glad your son is feeling better and it wasn't serious. So that's the good news.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
All right. Lend your buddy some money there.
No.
Yes, please.
No, thank you.
You lend me some money.
Yeah, Barney should be lending you money. Hey, listen, he's picked up the tab a couple times.
Yeah, he's good like that.
All right, so my thought on Frederick Anderson is, yeah, this, I think it was Kevin Woodley that brought it up the first time, is this is Frederick Anderson's MO. Throughout the course of a season, he's going to have some severe dips, man. There's some troughs.
The thing last year was that it coincided with the, actually, I shouldn't say the worst time, because he did bounce back in the postseason. He was awesome in the playoffs. And yeah, though it was actually super frustrating, because the one bad goal in a game seven completely changes the way that people remember what Freddie Anderson did for them through seven games last year.
Yeah.
Like how brilliant he was against Boston. But it did happen at the end of the year, which kind of raised more red flags, and which is why the confirmation bias, I think, settles in a little bit more. This season, it's happening more in the middle. And I think it's what I said off the top with Kevin Woodley. I think that the team is soft in their own end.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're banged up on the blue line.
Yeah.
They don't have guys who kill plays.
Yeah.
They give up a ton of odd man rushes. They give up a ton of slot chances. And they've been giving up more screenshots, too. And because they don't have the dudes to clear the front of the net.
Nope. And it gets a little better when Jake Muzzin returns, but that's...
Right. But ultimately, has Freddie been worse? Yes. He deserves a lot of criticism, too. I thought Bourne nailed it right on the head when he said maybe Freddie Anderson's mind was on the first tee at Augusta when he was allowing bad wraparound goals. And, like, every goal in that Chicago game that he allowed was bad.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't a good one in the bunch. He got lit up. And they left him in there, which is not what Sheldon Keefe has done in the past, because he's been playing better. That one kind of felt like he left him in there to be like, you eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, eat this one, because this one's on you. I think he'll bounce back. The difference is that, yeah, you're seeing it earlier in the season. It's lasting a little bit longer than normal Freddie Anderson slumps. And because of the workload, there's a higher intent up. Guess what's probably going to happen? It's probably going to normalize. It's probably going to be fine.
The difference to me is the Maple Leafs are operating without a safety net. That,
yeah, it's a high wire
start.
Up. But they never
to
had
the
one.
Season
they total... had Garrett Sparks the year before.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
I'm not talking about the backup goalie being the safety net.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about the safety net of building up points and having a regular, normal start for this hockey team, considering the talent. What they're going through now, they're not playing abhorrent hockey, save for like some stretches. But like the last five games, while the points have been scarce, like they were better than the Flames, right?
Mm-hmm.
They got beat by a better goaltender.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been playing awful, awful hockey like they were pretty much night in, night out under Mike Babcock to start the year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big takeaway for me, is like, yeah, this is a normal stretch for Frederick Anderson. This is a normal stretch for this hockey team. It's not an elite team like the Boston Bruins. They're not going to play at a 120-point pace or whatever they were for the first 15 games under Sheldon Keefe. Like, that's unrealistic for this group to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when they have their normal, you know, dip, which they would have had under Sheldon Keefe, if he had started the season, it would have been fine then, because they would have had their normal amount of points. They don't have their normal amount of points for what this hockey team is now. They have far fewer, because they had that incredibly awful stretch under Mike Babcock in which they were, 9-10-1. And that's totally killed any room for error. And Florida's better. So now you're in a situation where it's dire. It really is, as you approach the deadline and you're already all in for the season, and it's going to be hard for Kyle Dubas not to double down.
Should probably treat the Florida game seriously.
Yeah, in retrospect.
With some professionalism.
You would think. All right, when we come back, reflections. It's Good Shows Leafs Hour, presented by Drive Auto Group, fueled by customer expectations. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Leafs Hour, brought to you by Drive Auto Group, fueled by customer expectations. Ben Ennis, JD Bunkus. Bye week concludes over the weekend, the All-Star game, and then Leafs back in action on Monday, so that's good. Hockey games are good when we were talking about Leafs Hour. Time for reflections. I really like your second one there.
Yeah,
I'm really interested in.
So yesterday, Joel Quenneville returned to Chicago, and it was a raucous affair.
Mm-hmm.
Standing ovation. Obviously, like, who in the stands would ever be mad at Quenneville? And these are completely different circumstances. Like, so before you get up in arms, yeah, he won there.
Yeah.
He established a culture there.
Right.
And he still is arguably one of the best coaches in the NHL, but he's a proven winner.
Mm-hmm.
Someone where they just needed a change of pace, and they weren't going to be trading. They couldn't get rid of Seabrook. They couldn't trade Keith. They couldn't trade Taves. They weren't trading Kane. They had their core set. So what did they have to do? They had to trade their coach. And by trade, I mean fire. And so he was celebrating. And I did wonder, will there ever come a time where Mike Babcock returns to Toronto under positive circumstances. Because you and I are both in the camp of people underrate what he's done here. People overstate this season in terms of what he's done. They underappreciate what he meant when he first came to this city. And the success that this team had so unbelievably rapidly.
Yeah.
Of course, they had talent right out of the gate, but remember, the Leafs went from being a cellar dweller, the worst placed team in the NHL, to making the postseason. And yeah,
you have to give them credit for that.
Like, no duh.
And you have to give them credit in some of the development of the young players.
Exactly. And a lot of those guys have said as much, right? Even Mitch Marner, when that whole thing blew up about
Listgate
blew up, right? And I'm not gonna say that was a good moment of coaching, but Marner after it had the pretty clear cut opportunity to say, yeah, that really, I didn't recover from that. He was like, oh, right, that. Overall, I'm better with Mike Babcock. We were cool after that, even though that sucked. People have ups and downs in relationships, and if you're on the outside of it and you just see the down, then, yeah, I guess that's the judgment you're going to make. He did end up being, like, looked at and perceived at as though he was, like, this unruly, abusive figure, even though just most of it was that he wasn't a player's coach and wasn't popular because he was a taskmaster. I wonder how long it will be before... or whether it will require this team winning a Stanley Cup.
Yeah, they have to win a round at least.
No, right? Like, I'm not saying this year.
No, I'm saying because I think he's going to be in the league next year.
No. Oh, you think so?
I do. I think Mike Babcock gets back into the league next year.
If he's in the league next year and he's on the opposing bench, I think it's a mix of cheers and boos.
Oh, I think especially if this team doesn't make the playoffs.
Yeah.
Although it's weird to think of opposing coaches getting booed after they were fired in this place. But yeah, he's definitely not getting cheered. If they rebound here after the All-Star break in the second half, they make the playoffs, they win a round or two, I don't think they necessarily have to win a Stanley Cup for his reception to be more positive than negative. But yeah, if they miss the playoffs or they lose in the first round again, a lot of people are going to think about the things that I said. And they'll think about me specifically in the last block and think, yeah, man, you're the reason we didn't make the playoffs because you were so stubborn, you were so hard-headed, and while you did some good things for this team was all in for this season, and you kept them from even having a shot in the playoffs because they got off to a horrible start under you. So they're going to have to win a round. They're definitely going to have to make the playoffs, but I do think, obviously,
that's your take?
What?
That's why they would miss the playoffs, is it's all Mike Babcock's fault? Like, that's such an oversimplification.
I think... that, yeah, this team, as it stands right now, is a fine enough team to make the playoffs. And the reason that they don't make the playoffs is, one, the injuries have been horrible. But, two, that, yeah, their start set them back points-wise, hugely. Yes, that's my take.
I think that's a wild oversimplification of things. Like, I don't think that things are that black and white. Do I think that he contributed to that? Like, yeah, does he own a share of the blame? But, like, yeah, to simply put it as, like, the reason if this team struggles to get...
No, it doesn't make the playoffs.
Yeah, if they don't do that, I'm not being oversimplifying it and putting it. Like I said with Kevin Woodley off the top of the show, things are more complicated than people want to make it seem, and that's like the ultimate...
Well, dude, obviously it's not like entirely that, and there's reasons. Like if this team was really as good as it could have been, and if these players were really as good, they could have overcome some coaching.
Mm-hmm.
But like if I had to put my finger on one reason if they don't make the playoffs, it would be because, yeah, mathematics. Mm-hmm. They got off to a horrible start. And if they missed the playoffs, boy,
what position did Babcock play? What was he was he the center or was he the lefty?
So do you
was
think
he the goalie?
Okay, so
he was a goalie, right? He was a goalie.
Do you think they're off to the same start? Do you think, just answer this question? Do you think, so they were 9-10-4 when Mike Babcock was fired? Do you think they're 9-10-4 under Sheldon Keefe?
No. What do you think they are? Let's do speculation talk.
How many points, if they miss the playoffs, how many points do you think it'll be, like, if you had to guess? Like, is it going to be more than 10?
Okay, but let's say that it's that they miss because of 2 points, right?
Yep.
What do you think is more valuable? The off night of a Freddie Anderson, the off night of the team where they dog it in Florida, or the start with Mike Babcock and his coaching? Like, it's ridiculous.
But what can you control?
The players.
The head coach.
They play on the team.
You can control the players?
No, they...
I think the coaches have proved that they can't.
Yeah.
What they can control is the ice time. And if you just admitted that they have a better record than 9-10-4 under Sheldon Keefe, then you would admit that they would have maybe 2, maybe 4 points, and maybe they missed the playoffs by a point or two.
Again.
They make the playoffs, and we know the NHL playoffs, especially the first round, are a random.
I don't know how you add that in terms of, like, where your logic is when you go, the coaches can, like, I don't even understand the argument. It's so...
I thought it was pretty clear.
No, it's not. It makes no sense.
I just said that they have a better record to start the year with Sheldon Keefe than they would have with Mike Babcock. And those points would have been enough to make the playoffs if they end up missing.
And they have a better record if they have a better backup goaltender. They have a better record if they don't have some injuries on the blue line. They have a better record if some of their players had more attention to detail.
I don't know how to fix those ones. I don't know how to fix those ones. The ones I know how to fix is start with a different head coach.
All right.
Okay. I don't know why that's confusing. When we come back, Alvin Williams, it's a good show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.